8 o'clock. Another day, another talk. Sometimes I feel like I am a talk machine. You put me down somewhere, press the button, and out comes a talk. So I was at Nolamara last night giving a talk while the nuns were entertaining you here. And even when I leave here, there's always more talks all over the place. But this is my life, and it's always the case that you can struggle and fight the nature of life, and therefore you can suffer. But I always, this was actually when a Singaporean, it's amazing this happens in places like Singapore, they came to see me one day. They were very interested in Buddhism, but they say they didn't have much time. Like I mean, about 5 minutes for me to explain Buddhism to them. And so they say, well, this suffering, what is suffering? And that's when you're put on the spot, having to give a quick answer, you know, think on the run, as they say. And you're always sometimes amazing what you come up with. And so what I came up with, like, suffering is asking from this world what it can't give you. And I thought that was actually really smart. Because there's so much in this world you would want, you would like, but the world can't give you that. Now the world is limited. It consists of other people who may not think exactly like you think. So because of that, sometimes you would like the retreat to go on longer. You would like the retreat to have finished a couple of days ago. You would like Mr. Trump not to have been elected president. You would have liked so the economy to be going well. You would like to have a very fit and healthy body. You would like to be able to eat lots without getting fat. But unfortunately, that is not how this world works. So when we ask from the world what it can't give you, that's obviously asking for a lot of turmoil and strife and struggle. So asking for your wife always to be kind and always to see just how perfectly wise you are and how that you are always correct. Asking your wife to do that, impossible. That just can't be done. And asking your wife never get upset and angry. They don't make wives like that. So because of that, please know that all suffering is asking from this world what it can't give you. And so when we understand that, a bit of wisdom, then I've been here for 8-9 days. Why can't I get jhana every meditation? You're asking what this world can never give you. So a lot of times we become wise, we understand what's possible, what's not possible, and we live within our spiritual means. By which I want to explain that we do our very best, we meditate, we put our backside on the meditation cushion or the meditation chair, and we do our dana, we keep our precepts, we do compassionate acts, we do our very best, and we don't expect the jhanas just to come like that. We don't expect, okay, I'm following the monk's instructions, just sit under the mango tree perfectly still. Oh, I've been doing that for 6 or 7 days and no mango has fallen. Perhaps it won't ever fall. How could I trust you, Ajahn Brahm? And again, we're asking from the world what it can't give us. That all our meditation, our enlightenment follows our agenda when we want it. It's amazing. When you leave here, sometimes you haven't got such great supporting conditions, and you're on the aircraft, you start meditating, or, you know, in an aircraft lounge somewhere, you know, just on a seat there in the airport, or you're at home, just, you know, 5 or 10 minutes, nothing to do, you start meditating, and you get really deep meditation. You go, wow, how come? It's because, yes, you've been sitting under the mango tree. The mango is falling, but it takes a while for it to fall into your hand. The old simile, which is actually a bona fide joke, about, I'm not sure I told you about the refugee who came to Australia. He's working. He went to work on a building site. There's no way he can get jobs pretty easily. Went to work on a building site, worked really hard, you know, very diligent worker. And at the end of the day, he went home, and his wife said, "How much did you earn today, darling?" He said, "Nothing. They didn't pay me." He went there on Tuesday and Wednesday, still same thing happened, didn't get paid. Thursday morning, he told his wife, "I'm not going to work. In Australia, they just exploit you. They don't pay you." And his wife said, "Oh no, you must go. See what happens on Thursday." Went on Thursday, still never got paid. And he only went to work on Friday because he had nothing else to do. He worked really hard on Friday. And mid-afternoon, the boss gave him a big pay packet. And when he went home, he told his wife, "I now understand how it works in Australia. From now on, I'm only going to work on Fridays." And that's what it looks like, you know, on the outside. But of course, you all know that you are being paid on Friday for everything you did on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And that's exactly how it works with meditation as well. You've got to do the work to accumulate some credit, to get some credit of peace and stillness as much as possible. And when you get a certain amount of credit, then you get the check. And as I often say, your meditation, the check is in the mail. It's coming. It might get lost a little bit, but it's in the mail. It's coming. So this is one of the reasons why one of the greatest things we could do, when we understand wisdom, we understand what this world can give us and when it can give it to us, so we don't demand more than what's possible. When we don't demand anything, that's when we can get some peace and stillness. We understand what's the limits. And that's a lot of time in meditation, in insights, we understand exactly what this world can give us and what it can't. And then we know why we suffer. So, but there are some times the world can give us something. So that's where we put a little bit of effort in. Because today's talk is going to be about right effort. And you might think it's about time because we've been doing absolutely nothing all week. And now we talked about right effort at the very end, the last day. But you have been putting in right effort, even though you may not have really understood what right effort is. And I have to mention this talk because I get some criticism sometimes. People say, "Well, the Buddha talked about right effort. We should be doing something. We should be striving. We should be struggling. And if we don't strive and struggle, how are we going to get anything?" Precisely. You're not supposed to get anything. You're supposed to lose stuff. Which is why people sometimes come up to me and say, "You had this great education, and you just wasted it, just being a monk." Ajahn Brahm, they say, "You're a loser." And when they say that, it's supposed to be a term of abuse to call someone a loser. But I go, "Sadhu, sadhu, thank you for that compliment." Because as Buddhists, we're supposed to be losers. We're supposed to lose greed, hatred, delusion, lose the past, lose the future, lose all your restlessness and your sloth and torpor, lose all your defilements, lose all your greed and wanting, lose all your suffering. We're supposed to be losers. So next time someone calls you a loser, say, "Thank you for that wonderful compliment. I never realized that you appreciated me so much. Thank you. But I'm trying harder to be even a bigger loser. But, you know, give me time, I'm getting there." Because apparently there was a show called The Biggest Loser. And I wonder what that show was about. And it's all about people losing weight. That's stupid. Because weight is a sign of your prosperity in Chinese culture. And it's weird that a monk with no money can look so prosperous. But actually what happens, and some of you actually have been having this experience in the meditation, that I'm just going off on a tangent a minute. You know that sometimes in meditation, you get to a stage in meditation, your mind's really, really peaceful. Nimittas haven't really come up yet, but just before nimittas, when you experience some weird stuff in your mind, sometimes people feel that they're floating up into the air. Sometimes they're expanding or exploding or sinking into the ground. Sometimes you feel you're rocking, but yet perfectly still. All that's really happening there is, for want of a better word, I said perception gets a bit of freedom, gets its wings. Because your perception is just so defined, it's so conditioned, it's so brainwashed. You know, from culture and from school and from your environment. We are taught to see things in one way, and there's hundreds of other ways to see it. You know, it starts off in school, you know, boy, girl, house, tree, dog. But perception, that's only one minor part of what you're experiencing. And what happens in meditation? You get to a certain stage of letting go. Well, actually the mind starts to let go of all the ways it's been taught to see things, and it can see things in other ways. And one of the examples I give, which is a personal example, which was really strange for me at the time, until I realized what's happening, was in the monastery in Thailand, I went past the washing area, and there I saw, you know, a few things on the line to dry, and what I saw, which really shocked me, was there was a black towel on the line, perfectly jet black. And I stopped and thought, that's weird. I don't know anyone who has a black towel. In fact, you can go to shops these days. You can see all different colors of towels. White, pink, orange, yellow. But have you ever seen a black towel being sold in some shopping center in Australia? They don't do black towels. In fact, it would be a wonderful thing to have a black towel because then you wouldn't need to wash it so often. It would be a good idea. But there I saw this black towel and I was rubbing my eyes and saying, this is weird, I don't know anyone with a black towel. I've never seen a black towel in my life. This is really strange. So it was about for 3 minutes, 4 minutes, something around that time, I was just staring at it in disbelief. And then suddenly it just changed back to white again. It was a white towel. All the time it was a white towel, but my perception was starting to play tricks, play around. And later on, you see in the word of the Buddha started saying this, that some monks, they start to mess around with their perception so they can see full light as if it was darkness, darkness as if it was light. Your perceptions can do amazing things. And what's really happening now is all my controls were being let go, and my perception was playing around. And that's what it really is. It's fascinating when you see just how you can perceive things in a totally different way, that's how limited your perception actually is. And how we are so attached to one way of perception, we can't see any other type of perception. And that's also why it's wonderful to actually to experience different cultures. Because every one of our cultures actually does see the world in a very different way. And especially indigenous cultures which haven't been affected, you know, by the power of the Western culture these days, through TV and movies. And little things, like in the northeast of Thailand when I was there. And there were so many funerals in the monasteries where we were. And we'd see the villagers the day before, the day after, after that. And even though that very close loved ones died, there was not any grief. I never saw grief. It was foreign to that culture, which is weird. But, you know, that was because it was an indigenous Buddhist culture. The Northeast had never been colonized. The French tried, the English tried, but no one actually managed to get that area. So they were totally independent and just a totally different way of looking at things. And because of that, that started to see just many of the things which I thought were right and wrong. It's just perception. One of the other things which I remembered, there was one of the villagers who would come to the temple often. Even though he came to the temple, when there was a party on, he really got involved in the party. And these parties used to go on for days. And this particular fellow got totally drunk. And as he was drunk, sort of riding along on the road in his bicycle, wrong side of the road, middle of the night, no lights, totally drunk, and he got hit by a bus. And the bus driver had to flee. Because according to the way that Thai law perceives it, the owner of the bigger vehicle is always responsible. And so the owner of the driver of the bus would have been prosecuted for that, even though the guy was drunk, no lights, wrong side of the road. No, you've got the bigger vehicle, therefore you have to look out for the smaller vehicles. And I thought that's a very interesting perspective, which actually changed some of my ideas about, you know, law and legal systems. Or even things, you know, basic, like war. Because one of my friends over there, you remember Titapo? He was in Luang Prabang during the Vietnam War. Luang Prabang was the second city of Laos. And he was there one day having lunch in one of these, you know, Asian restaurants, bamboo thatch, absolutely no hygiene, but the food was delicious. So he's having his lunch there, and he noticed that on another table close by were the government soldiers, now the royalist soldiers. Remember, this was a war going on. This was, you know, not messing around. And so he saw the soldiers there. They had the machine guns against the thatched wall, just leaning there while they're having their lunch. And then, to his horror, he saw the communist troops coming into the restaurant, the Pathet Lao, with their machine guns. And he was about to dive under the table. You know, this was war, and he got the two different sides, the two soldiers from the different armies, were just going into the same restaurant. But what the communist Laotian soldiers did, they just sat at another table. They put their guns against the wall and ordered their lunch. Because in that part of the world, this is really weird for American or Middle East culture, but in that part of the world, war always stops for lunch. Lunch is more important. And when you get your head around that, you think, well, why not, you know, perceive things in a different way. And so, anyway, so that was some of the different perceptions which actually happen. And this is actually what happens to in your meditation sometimes. You start to see things in a totally different way. See it from an angle which your culture has actually prohibited you from seeing. And so when all those barriers, all those restraints are taken off, you see things in a totally different way. Your body's not supposed to rise in the air. But that's what it feels like. The body's not supposed to, like, balloon out like some of you have already experienced. But this was one of my problems. It happened to me once. There I was meditating, and my body was expanding. And my problem was, someone disturbed me. I came out of meditation, and I got kind of stuck. So, you know, this is where this comes from. It's just like a meditation problem. It's not fat, it's just, you know, I was expanding and you disturbed me. I have got loads and loads of excuses. But that's what happens sometimes in meditation. Sometimes our perception has to be sort of changed. So there is a time in meditation where you just let it go with the flow. You're perfectly safe. In fact, that particular stage when your perception starts to play around, that is always so much fun. Because, you know, you've been meditating a long time, you know, and you're watching your breath. This was where it gets interesting. Weird stuff. Because I love weird stuff. One of the weird stuff which was very important for me, actually, I'm going off subject again, but it's an important part of the meditation, was when I again went to the Zen monastery. Early times in UK, you didn't really have any choice where to go to do a retreat or do some meditation. And any place you'd go to, even if it was a different tradition, because there's no places to go. So I went to this Zen monastery in the north of England, and that was where they came around with the Zen stick. You know, this guy coming around. And you had your backs to the aisle in between, and you were facing the wall. And if you got at all sleepy, he'd tap me once on the shoulder and then whack! And he said, it doesn't hurt, it's just to wake you up. I didn't believe that. But I was always one of these monks with good karma. And I was born with good karma. And so, it was brilliant because I was sleepy on a Sunday morning as a student. You know, you stay up late at night. So there you were, Sunday morning, early in the morning, cold in this, I think it was a stable or something, converted into a meditation hall. And there you were facing the wall. And I was really sleepy, starting to nod. But my lucky karma was that there's always someone nodding more than me. So he got whacked. And as soon as I heard that, all my sloth and torpor totally vanished. It was replaced by fear. It wasn't a good reason to stop meditating, overcome your... It's just one defilement gone, but another one came up. I was just so afraid. But the interesting thing about that particular retreat was we were supposed to meditate with our eyes open. And you know, it's best to keep your eyes closed, basically, when you're meditating. It's just one less sense to really worry about. Because your brain has to deal a lot with sensory data, mostly with sight. And just to close the eyes means that's one less thing you have to be concerned about. So you get more space in the brain to be mindful of other stuff, like feelings in the body and later on experiences in the mind, in the sixth sense. But here we were asked to keep our eyes open, and I thought, well, why not? Give it a try. I was always, you know, into something new. So there I was, watching this whitewashed wall and with no instructions. Now, these Zen teachers, they don't give you much instructions. They just say, well, watch the wall, see what happens. Now, it worked for me because I'd already done enough meditation. I could let go of the past and the future and calm down my thoughts. If that was most people, they'd be just thinking about all sorts of things. They wouldn't be really watching the wall. So I was there quite peaceful, quiet, just watching this wall, not really expecting anything. And that was when the weird stuff happened. The wall vanished. It disappeared. It wasn't there anymore. And that was strange. And for me, this was in the 60s or 70s, when weird was the coolest thing ever. Anything strange, yeah, I was into it. So, the wall vanished. It was weird. But one thing, because of training in science, you know, you contemplate it afterwards. Why? What happened? How come you were looking at a wall and suddenly it just wasn't there? And it didn't take much contemplation to realize that's just the nature of the brain. It's nothing weird or supernatural. All it is you recognize that anything which stays stable, which doesn't move, after a while the brain turns off. It doesn't sort of register anymore. Exactly the same, your computer screen, if you don't click the mouse, what happens to the computer screen? It turns off, it goes blank. That's exactly what happens with your brain. The sound of an aircon, the sound of traffic in the background, the hum of your heartbeat, all of that, if you don't do anything, it vanishes. So, this was an important teaching on how meditation works. We keep still to allow our five senses to vanish. If you keep moving, your body never disappears. If you keep doing stuff, your sense of self never disappears. If you leave your the sense of body doesn't disappear. If you keep your eyes open, there's always things moving, people coming and going. So sight doesn't disappear. So one way of looking at this meditation, being still so that things will vanish. So, with that perspective, imagine what happens when you sit down to meditate. You close your eyes. And when you first close your eyes, if you notice, you'll see the insides of your eyelids. If it's a bright day, they actually appear quite red. Because there's the blood, you can see the light filtering through your eyelids and see a red colour. Mostly you close your eyes and it's like a black. But next time, notice how long does that image stay? The inside of your eyelids is usually only a few seconds. And you never actually know that time when now you're watching it and now it's gone. Just like the time when you actually fall asleep. It's a process, it's not an event. So now you know, well, I'm not seeing things anymore. I'm not seeing the inside of my eyelids. My sense of sight has turned off. The switch has been flipped. And now you're not seeing anything. Because you have got your eyes closed, that it's not changing, the sense of sight stops. And that gives you the key for what happens next. Smell, as long as nobody passes wind, farts, the smell in this room stays the same. Which is one of the reasons why I ask people, if you do have bad digestion and you do tend to fart a lot, please sit in the back so that there's no one behind you to smell what comes out. If you sit in the front, then there's so many people behind you have to endure the smell. So now you know why many people have been meditating a lot and know the instructions. Why people sit in the back? Or against the wall. But as long as the smell stays the same roughly, after a while you can't smell anything. You never notice when you go into the dining room for lunch, you can smell, you know, the smell of the food. It's really delicious, you know, lunch is coming, you smell all the beautiful flavours, or not whatever it is, the smells of the food. But how long does that sensation last? After a little while, you can't smell the food anymore because it's the same. The brain only notices things which change. The taste of your saliva, gone after a little while. So that's already sight, smell, taste, three of the senses gone. Now you're left with two tough ones, the hearing and the physical touch. Hearing should be easier to actually overcome because we try and keep quiet here. And please, you know, somebody's mobile phone, I think the get up alarm went this morning. Please make sure your mobile phone or your iPhone or whatever else you have is turned off. Imagine that someone this morning was just about to get streaming and your phone went off just before. Ooh, that's very bad karma. Your poor mobile phone will have a very bad rebirth. It will be reborn as a speed camera in its next existence. The lowest form of technology next to parking meters. So the whole point is that as long as the sound is the same, you can be meditating in a city somewhere, as long as the background hum of the noise doesn't change, after a while you don't hear it. You can have the aircon on. Fortunately, it's been, you know, pretty good weather here. But if it gets really hot, the next retreat in January is usually really hot, so put the aircon on. And it's a hum, the aircon makes a noise. But because it's constant, it's on all the time, after a while you can't hear it anymore. So that is why you don't need to be in a perfectly silent place to meditate. As long as it's the ambient noise is constant, no big change in the amplitude, then your sense of sound turns off. And the last one, your body. Now, if any of you want to have a look, understand what we mean here, have a look at what people are doing now. Somebody is actually scratching their ear. Somebody is scratching their, or adjusting their blanket. Somebody else is scratching their nose. And I'm just describing what I'm seeing. Now, we do that without really thinking. But if you actually notice how people move, it shows you, it proves just how much discomfort there is in this body. we're always having to blink our eyes, to actually to take off our glasses, just to adjust our hands, just to and scratch our nose, just to scratch our nose again over there. And we do this without thinking, because we always do it, because our body is always itching somewhere, aching somewhere. It always needs to be moved this way and that way, because it really is a pain. So this is very hard to actually to let the body go. And the only way you can make it comfortable is to sit it down as comfortable as possible, relax it, and then just let it disappear. Even myself, I scratch my nose, move stuff around. But when you meditate, because you totally leave the body alone, that's the only time it's comfortable, when you're not paying attention to it. Otherwise, it's always asking you to scratch something, to cough, to sneeze, to adjust something, to move your leg, wiggle your bottom, now adjust your shirt, and again, I'm just saying what I'm seeing in front of me. So the body is really a pain. So what happens is we try and take our attention away from the body. Once it's relaxed as much as possible, take your attention away by putting onto the breath. Just breathing and nothing else. We do this because, as I mentioned, the breath becomes a stepping stone, the way you can actually go from body awareness to no body awareness at all, just by doing this tiny body awareness called the breath. So you're watching the breath, and hopefully you watch the breath, and so all your body vanishes. You're not paying any attention to it, it just goes, disappears. And then you've got to try somehow or other, let the breath vanish. The perception of the breath vanish. And the way you do that is by calming the breath down so it becomes quite smooth. And so you can't really see the difference between the beginning and end of a breath. In fact, the in-breath and the out-breath, they also start to look exactly the same. When it gets smooth like that, so there's hardly any difference, that is when the breath vanishes. Just like watching a white wall, nothing changed. And so the sense of sight turned off for me. Now, because you're being reasonably still, and the breath is just the same going in, same going out, that's when it vanishes. There's nothing to watch anymore. The brain just clicks off. Nothing really necessary, because your brain is only noticing things which change. So that's actually why stillness leads to samadhi. Why it's only through stillness that things like five senses can actually vanish. So why do we do that for anyway? Why do we allow the five senses to vanish? Number one, it's great fun. You have so much joy and peace and happiness when you don't have to worry about this body. And of course, you all manage to do that sooner or later. Don't think you can't do this. I guarantee 100% you will be able to let go of your body one day. When you die. So this is actually training for that time. We have so much training, training how to give birth, training just how to drive a car, training in your career. So it's amazing that people don't teach you how to die. But we do here. Our Buddhist monasteries are so kind, we give you training for everything. And this is Training How to Die 101 at Jhana Grove. Because you have to let go sooner or later, but there's all these marvelous stories of near-death experiences, NDEs, of people who die, and they come back to tell you what it's like. Every time, and one of my monks recently went under anesthetic, not this one, he's in the library now, and I asked him, under anesthetic, when I'm conscious, yes, did you have an NDE, did you? He said, no. So, oh, what a waste. People have heart attacks and I go and see them in the hospital and they survive. I said, do you have a near-death experience? And he said, is that all you're interested in? I said, yes. Oh, I've seen people die. I get bored about that after a while. But anyway, every now and again somebody does. And when they do, it's great.
to actually to get their experiences of what happened. And one of my favourite anecdotes of a near-death experience was actually on a BBC documentary on NDEs. BBC does some really, really good documentaries. But the person they got to actually to relate their out-of-body experience was absolutely brilliant. Because she was one of these people who was always sick, if not one thing, then another thing. So her body was a mess. It was a case study. But she had some operation to try and fix up something else which was wrong with her. And she died on the operating table, came back afterwards. And this is the story she told on the BBC. She said that she floated out of her body. She could see all the people operating on her, freaking out because, you know, she was flatlining. And she said she was as happy as could be. She was floating out of her body. At last, a really sick, irritating, you know, so many diseases body, she was free of it. And she was having such a wonderful time out of her body, the best time she'd had for years, when she met what she said was a spirit. And the spirit came to tell her, "Madam, it's not your time. You have to go back." To which she replied, "No way. I don't want to go back to that old body. I've been enduring it for years. This sickness, that sickness, this medication, that operation. No, I've had enough. I'm staying here." And that was just the start of this huge argument in the NDE play, whatever you want to call it. And they were arguing battles, "But you have to." "But I don't want to go." "But it's not your time." "I don't care. I'm staying here." "But you must go back." "No, it's your karma. I don't care." And the argument ended, apparently, according to this woman. Obviously, she lost the argument because she came back to tell the tale. When she said that spirit somehow or other got hold of her and literally threw her back into her old body. And that's when she revived. And when she told the story, that's the nicest part. After she told that part of the story, you could see her face really screw up with utter rage, anger. I've never seen anyone look so angry, because she said, "Now, I can't do this. I've been a monk for too long to really play about trying to be angry." She said something like, "Now, when I die next time, the first thing I'm going to do, I'm going to find that spirit. And what I'm going to do to him, you wouldn't really imagine. I'm going to beat him up. I'm going to crucify him. I'm going to tear him apart. What he did to me is unforgivable." And if you think it's hard to forgive some people, she was no way could she forgive that spirit. But the reason why I found it funny was because, you know, just how wonderful it was just to die. She didn't want to come back again. I don't know why you are all so worried about dying. To me, bring it on. If you really knew what it was, especially when you get old and sick and aching and stuff like that. Oh, marvellous. Last you're free. You can float like a bird and have a wonderful time. But it just shows you what it's like when your five senses disappear. It's wonderful. You're so free. No bodily aches and pains. No need to scratch your nose. No need to worry about flies or mosquitoes. So this is actually one of the great joys of deep meditation. Not only are you understanding what it's like to die, you're experiencing the five senses, God. You're also understanding just how wonderful it is to let go of all these sights, sounds, smells, tastes and touches. Oh, they are literally such a burden, such a heavy weight on your mind. You know, you're free of those things. Oh, great. This shows you some of the joy of meditation and also understanding a little bit about the Four Noble Truths. Why the Buddha said life is suffering. What do you mean it's suffering? That's just a negative attitude. You monks, you should get a life. Come on. You monks, because you're afraid of relationships. That's what you're trying. You nuns as well. Just because you've had your heart broken. It doesn't mean you have to become a nun for your life. Somebody asks, sometimes they ask me these weird questions that I don't give straight answers. I used to give straight answers when I was a young monk, but now I usually mess around with people. And they said, Ajahn Brahm, why did you become a monk? And I said, because of a broken heart. And people thought, oh, that's so romantic. You poor man. And I said, I became a monk to forget. And to say, forget what? And I said, I don't know, I forgot. But at least it's logically consistent. But I didn't become a monk to forget. At least I don't think so. Maybe I did. But there we go. You become a monk and then because it's just so much happiness. You let go of your body when you want to. Woohoo! Be free. So number one, it tells you just, you know, what it's like to die. It also tells you, you know, why the Buddha said these five senses of suffering, why they're dukkha. It's not only theory anymore. They are dukkha. You let them go, and wow! It's like a big burden that's gone off from you. Understanding that insight, just the insight of what it's like to be free of this body when you get into deep meditation. Number one, it gives you a lot of understanding about the First Noble Truth, about suffering. And number two, you won't be afraid of death anymore. Either yours or somebody else's. Sometimes people think that I'm callous. I don't get upset when people die. You know, King of Thailand. I didn't get upset when he died. You know, but that's disrespectful. It's not. You know, the King of Thailand, he's sick for so many years. I know he'd feel so free of, you know, that really heavy body. Just like your mother, your father. When my mother died, I wasn't sad at all. You know, it's my mother, you know, the person who nurtured you when you were very young. Because she had dementia. What I thought straight away was, wow, great mum, you're now free of that prison. You know, of an old body, dementia. You can actually fly now, you're free. I felt so happy for my mum. Just the same as I would have felt if she was giving a jail sentence for some bad karma she did. And now she has been released from jail. That's how I thought. My mum is now free. But when you understand sort of what happens when the five senses vanish, wow, it's amazing. And you experience that. You could let go from stillness. And things vanish. Now, what happens next? You get into these incredible minds. Well, let's go to limiters first of all. Actually, I was going to do about right effort. I haven't done any right effort yet, but maybe. I'm just enjoying myself. Where do you get these. I'll give you a break. Where do you get these limiter stages? Again, it's so energetic, there's so much power there. You know, somehow or other, you've got to make them still. And to me the insight was, I knew I had to get them still, but I really couldn't get them still. The insight which came, and just the personal one, which I share with you, because if you get to the limiters, this is what really worked for me. Just, you know, you're having a problem in meditation, it lasts for weeks or months sometimes, and then something happens, something triggers you. You understand what the problem is. What triggered me? I was shaving in the morning. A simple thing like that. Shaving in the morning, maybe brushing your teeth or whatever, and I noticed the image in the mirror was moving. It wasn't the mirror's fault. It was because me, the one who was watching, was moving. That was why the image was moving. And it just clicked. Now that's it, with the limiters. The only reason those lights are moving is because me, the one who was watching, I was moving. That's what it was. And as soon as I got that angle of nimitta meditation really clear in my mind, it became so simple now. When I watched those nimittas, I would keep still. I wouldn't worry about the nimitta. I wouldn't worry about the mind, the mirror in which this was all happening. It was just the one who was watching. Paid a little bit of attention to that and kept that still. When I was still, the nimitta was still. That's all I needed to do. started being of great power, really brilliant limiters, and then they weren't moving. You know what happens when things are still? They disappear. And all that was left was the bliss. So there I had to get another simile. How do you explain that for people? And fortunately, another story from Alice Through the Looking Glass, and that was the story of the Cheshire Cat. And that fellow, you know, it was really weird, that Lewis Carroll, but he certainly had a very, very good imagination, and some of the stuff he said is just so accurate. He gives so many good similes to meditation. And this was the Cheshire Cat, where this Cheshire Cat appeared on a tree, and Alice saw it, and then suddenly it vanished. And then it appeared again, and then suddenly vanished. And Alice says something like, Mr. Cat, you know, when you vanish, it really makes me get a headache. If you are going to vanish, can you vanish slowly, please? And the cat said, certainly. And so the cat vanished slowly. First of all, its tail disappeared, and then its legs, and then its body, just leaving the head. And then the head started to vanish. First of all the ears, and then the whiskers, and the eyes, and then the whole head disappeared, leaving only the smile, because Cheshire Cats have got a smile on them. And Alice replied, that is really confusing. I've often seen a cat without a smile, but this is the first time I've seen a smile without a cat. And to me, that was such a wonderful simile to what happens in this state of meditation. You got happiness, a smile, without anything doing the smile. A smile without a cat. A smile without lips or a mouth. A disembodied smile. And that's what's left. So these are things vanishing. And this becomes really refined and very interesting. It seems some amazing stuff. And this is the jhanas. A smile without any mouth to do the smile. Really beautiful smile. And I mentioned here there's hardly anything going on there, so you're pretty still. And you know what happens, because you're still, things vanish. And as they vanish, you get into the second jhana. As more things vanish, the third jhana. More things vanish, the fourth jhana. The great disappearing act. Now what's vanishing is, your will is vanishing, joy is vanishing, and the next thing which vanishes is you. Your mind disappears. The knower is still. Anything which is still will turn off. So your whole mind, everything you are, turns off. And you're gone. Woohoo! If you think your body is a pain, so much itches, So many things to scratch. You know, you drink something, you've got to go to the toilet, you eat something, you've got to poo it out afterwards. Isn't there a better way to get some energy instead of all this eating? Somebody would thought, wouldn't it be wonderful? You get all the vitamins, all the nutrients in a pill. You just put the pill in your mouth, you don't have to go to the toilet and wipe your bum. You don't have to go to the toilet and just, you know, keep urinating all the time in the middle of the night if you get to my age. You don't have to go and do any of this sort of stuff. You just take a pill and you've got all the energy for the whole day. Wouldn't that be wonderful? Would you reckon? But unfortunately, it's only devas do that sort of stuff. We have to do all it the rough way. And endure this really very heavy body with so many demands on it. So that's actually what happens when you get still. Still is a great vanishing act. When Ajahn Brahmani, and I credit him for this, he called it the art of disappearing. That's what meditation is. Being a loser. Losing more and more and more. And the more you lose, the more free you are. The less you carry, the higher you float up into the sky. No weight, no gravity, no pain, no suffering. Free. But everything vanishes. That's called the art of disappearing. Now, right effort. So So right effort isn't really, even the word is one of these words that it doesn't really give the right meaning. So what was the word I was using recently? Instead of right effort, just right... No, not even motivation, that wasn't it. It was... Anyway. Not effort, anyway. The four right efforts, according to Buddhism. Okay, I'm going to go back a bit. Another one of my little stories. The Vipassana joke. There. I think I told you about I think I already said about the wealthy woman who went to the temple and told the guard to be mindful. Not here, okay. There was a very wealthy disciple, lived in a big mansion down in Dalkeith. That's the wealthy suburb of Perth. And she decided to go to the temple Friday night to listen to the talk. And because there was many robberies in the area, she had a guard, on the gate of her house. She told the guard, please be very mindful, because there's many burglars around. Next door neighbor's been burgled. Be mindful so you can protect the property. So, she went to listen to the talk. When she came back after the talk, she found her house had been burgled. And she said, I told you to be mindful. And the guard said, madam, I was mindful. I saw the burglars going in, and I noted, burglar going in, burglar going in, burglar going in. I saw them taking your jewellery out, and I noted, jewellery going out, jewellery going out, jewellery going out. I saw them back in their car, in the driveway, truck going in, truck going in. And I noticed them putting your safe in the back of the truck. Safe going out, safe going out. So I was totally mindful, madam, all the time, totally mindful. And of course, that's not good enough. Once you are mindful, there's also some obligations to make sure the bad people never get into your house. To stop them. And if they are in the house, call the police to get rid of them. And one of the best ways of avoiding burglars is having some of your friends over in the house. When there's good people in the house, the burglars can't come in. So invite good people in and try and keep them there until the owner of the house comes home. And that's my simile for the four right efforts. But you can keep the bad stuff out. And if it does get in somehow, find some way of letting it go so it doesn't stay very long. One of the best ways to avoid unwholesome states of mind is to have lots of good states of mind in there. Your friends. And somehow or other to keep them in there for a long period of time so the bad people can't come in. Those are the four right efforts. But all those four right efforts are all depending upon the results, making sure the bad stuff doesn't come into your mind, that's your house, and steal your happiness and steal your peace and steal your contentment and steal your joy, to steal your compassion, because that's what bad things do. You're really compassionate, but someone makes such a noise last night in your hut, you allow them to steal your compassion, and you scold them in the morning. They've stolen the compassion. Don't let burglars do that. So, we have to find some way of inviting good people in so the bad stuff doesn't come in, and keep the good stuff there. Those are basically the four right efforts. But how you do that? How do you actually abandon bad stuff in your mind? You try and get rid of it. And does it work? No. Which is where one of the great similes taught by the Buddha and adapted quite considerably by me. The story of the old anger-eating monster. There was an empress, I always tell this story, I haven't told it yet. An empress, she was on a meditation retreat. And so she left her palace for 9 days. And when she was away, this huge monster came into her palace. It was frightening, it was stinky, it was gross. And because she was away, because all the so-called security guards, they're okay when nothing happens. They stand there outside of Nolamara Center looking good. But if really bad guys came, they'd probably run a mile. So, that's what happened to these security guards at the palace. They hid under the tables, they went in the broom cupboards, they went behind the pot pollards, anywhere, because this was a really mean looking monster. And because the security never did their job, that allowed the monster to go right into the throne room and sit on the Empress's throne. That was just one step too far. Even though they were terrified, all the security guards, the soldiers, the ministers came out and said, "Get out of there! Who do you think you are, sitting in our Empress's chair? Get out, now!" And in those harsh words, the monster grew an inch bigger, more ugly, more smelly, more offensive. And that really upset all the guards. And they got out their swords, their clubs, their tasers, their whatever they had. But every unkind word, deed or thought, the monster just kept getting bigger, more ugly, more smelly, more of a problem. By the time the Empress came back after a 9-day retreat, this monster was absolutely gigantic and was more frightening. I've never seen this, but when I ask people what's the most frightening thing they've seen, it's alien in the movies. But maybe now it's changed. More frightening than Donald Trump in the White House. That monster. It was so stinky, so smelly. This is the word I came up with. I was quite proud of this English. So smelly that even the maggots crawling on its skin threw up. Not even maggots could endure the smell. But the reason she was empress was because she was the smartest of all the people in the kingdom. And she knew what to do. You know what she did? She didn't say, "Get out of here." She said, "Welcome, monster. Thank you for coming to visit me. Has anyone got you a cup of tea yet? We have Theravada tea, which is from Sri Lanka. We have Mahayana tea, which is green tea from China. We have Earl Grey tea. You know, it's posh tea. Whatever you want, what do you need? We could even get you something to eat." Because apparently, I've never had this because I don't go to these shops, you can get monster pizza. So they're going, because he's a monster. And every kind of word or deed, the monster going each smaller, less likely to make less offensive. So they all knew exactly what to do now. They never tried to get rid of the monster through ill will. They did it through kindness. Instead of trying to cure the problem, they cared for it. And every act of kindness, the monster was smaller and smaller, less likely, less smelly, less offensive. Until the monster was so tiny, one more act of kindness, and the monster vanished completely away. That's why the Buddha called that anger-eating monster. Give it ill will, it just gets bigger. Now, you know, how to get rid of the problems in the mind. Yeah, you want to get rid of them. But say, "Get out of here, sloth and torpor. Leave now, restlessness. Stupid sexual fantasy. Out." What happens? It gets bigger and more of a problem. This is right effort. You have to have real wisdom to do right effort. It's using willpower, which is mostly negativity, not being happy with what's going on, that just makes it worse. You try it. You've been doing that for years. You know it always makes it worse. Angry is him. So instead he says, "Stop and talk. Welcome. Thank you for coming to this." Ill will. Ah, can I get even more angry? This is what Ajahn Chah did once. He went to visit a monastery over in England, and one of the persons said, "I'm troubled with anger. How can I stop it?" He said, "Easy. Next time you're angry, sit down, get out a clock like this, put it in front of you, and see how long you'll be angry for. Really try and beat your record." And that was Ajahn Chah's way of saying, don't try and stop it, encourage it. See if you can be more angry, longer. And as soon as you do that, the anger starts to vanish. So you're not feeling it, you're caring for it. You know, do you want a cup of tea, anger? You know, craziness. Oh, wonderful, craziness. Marvellous. Do you want a sort of a pizza? Craziness, madness. When you stop trying to get rid of it, it disappears. Just like the anger eating dinner. So that's actually how you get rid of the burglars in the house. Now he's got the burglars in the house. You're mindful enough, you see them coming before they come in. You know, once you see, for me there was a simile of the snakes. Because over in time there were so many snakes around, we didn't have any shoes, the sandals were always falling apart, and there you were, every, as I said, 900 species of snake, 99 are venomous, the other one strangles you to death. It's all really dangerous. And you had to walk through the forest at night time. Flashlight, no good. Batteries, and they're almost dead. And really scary. I never got bitten. You know why? Because I was on the lookout for snakes. When I went back, I wasn't sort of thinking about dependent origination or whistling a happy song. I was really looking. Because I was really looking for them, and now there's in my mind, be careful of snakes. You see like a black shape across the path. It could be a twig, it could be a shadow in the night time. You didn't take any chances. You either jumped over it or went by another path. That's why you never got bitten, because you avoided them before they could get you, because you're on the lookout for them. So if you've got any big problems like sleepiness or restlessness or boredom, whatever, be on the lookout for it. When you meditate, I've got to be really careful of this. That's the programming mindfulness stuff. Be really careful of like falling asleep at a certain time in meditation. And then actually you see it before it comes. And it's as simple as just taking another path. You don't need to put forth effort. Once the snake has got you, you need a lot of effort there, you know, to try and unwrap it from around you if it's a python. So this is one of the reasons why we need to see things earlier. It's called restraint. See it coming out. I'm not going there. You've been caught up so many times. A sexual fantasy, a plan or a dream. How many hours have you wasted? So you see it when it's just coming, it's so easy to say no. Once it's got you, it's very hard to unravel it. So, that's the effort to get rid of, to restrain, and to encourage beautiful stuff in your mind. And this is teddy bears. Is the third right effort. Cuddling a teddy bear, it always arouses wholesome states of mind. Kindness, softness, gentleness and peace. A sense of safety. Because, you know, it reminds you of when you were a kid, when you had no problems in life at all. The time when you didn't need to get enlightened. Nice and peaceful time. Now, unfortunately, you've become a Buddhist and there's all this stuff you have to do now. To keep your precepts, you have to give dana. Oh, dearie me. Now you've done your dana, you keep it, but now you've got to get jhanas. Oh, God, another problem I've got to do. So when you're a kid, you didn't have to do anything like that, so it's much more peaceful. So you take the teddy bear, nice and peaceful, which means that you can really relax. So this is actually how we encourage good states. Little things like smiling, remembering good Dhamma talks, anything which inspires you. Going outside and just looking at just the amount of dedication and sacrifice for this place. Oh, it's just so inspiring to see just the result of so many good people, really kind, dedicated, sacrificing people. Oh, that just brings tears to your eyes. So all of this stuff, this is how to encourage good stuff in the mind. And when the good stuff is in the mind, enjoy it. That's how it stays there. Sometimes people take it for granted and they think, yeah, it's a nice place, but you know, it's just another place. No, really indulge in the enjoyment of whatever you've achieved, whatever other people have achieved, which is how to encourage the joy in the mind. And yeah, that doesn't really take effort at all. None of the things I said take real much effort. All it takes is just right wisdom. Seeing things in a good way. And that is what really keeps those so-called four right efforts. So it's always wisdom power, never willpower. When you look at what the Buddha actually said, it's always like stopping. Stopping the bad stuff. That's what it is, just stopping. You don't have to kick them in the butt. That's what the US Marines do, kick butt. Buddhists just say stop, and it stops. And enjoying and encouraging the good stuff. And that's the best way of stopping bad stuff coming in the mind. Best way of stopping burglars, apart from having an ISIS flag in the front yard of your house. The best way of stopping burglars is having lots of good friends in your house. And then good states of mind prevent bad states even coming in. So if when you do have some happiness, please preserve it. Don't throw it away. Don't take it for granted. Look after it, care for it. And then it lasts a long time. Whew. Right effort. Okay, that's enough for today. Sadhu. 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 You're getting into it now, good. Okay, so now we have some interviews and then we have more meditation this afternoon. There is plenty of time. So don't pack your bags yet.